Welcome everyone to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Carlos Alcaraz is Indian Wells champion yet again. He wins his first title since Wimbledon. He beats many of his chief rivals to do so. Zverev, Sinner, Medvedev in the final. We're going to get into the latter two matches on this week's Monday Match Analysis. I have not been around to make podcasts, to do content. As I said at the start of the week, I was commentating at the Phoenix Challenger, the 175 that drew the great field second week of Indian Wells. At the end of the show, I want to talk about that too. I want to tell you all about it. What were my takeaways from some of the players that I got to watch up close and personal? And I'll also discuss some of my own experiences specific to commentating the event. And I'm really excited to get into all of that stuff. Just as excited as I am to discuss Carlos Alcaraz, whose game reached heights that it had not reached since Wimbledon. That much was very clear. And before I get into the specifics of what happened in the Sinner match, what happened in the Medvedev match, let's just talk about Alcaraz's improvement as a whole. It came down to fighting some of the self-destructive habits that had seeped into his game. Losses in focus, low percentage tennis, one speed power baselining that ultimately led to less dynamic and more error-filled tennis. What was the source of that? Why would Alcaraz fall prey to those habits? I think it came from a place deep inside of his mind that wanted to hit everything hard and constantly dictate. And Alcaraz just had to fight off those temptations. You could see patches of play where the devil on the shoulder, which shoulder is the devil and which is the angel? I forget, but the devil on the shoulder was maybe winning out for moments, like the first set against Sinner. We could see patches of it, but you could also see corrections quickly being made. And I do believe those corrections started on the practice court, especially after listening to Jim Courier on the Tennis Channel broadcast. Jim Courier and Juan Carlos Ferrero, they have a good relationship, and Courier is able to get a lot of insight and a lot of intel out of Ferrero that American audiences who are watching Tennis Channel got the pleasure of being enlightened. So here's what Courier said slash reported on the broadcast. They are trying to program Alcaraz to play less risky. They have been doing drills, forcing Carlitos to hit two slower, higher, spinnier shots before injecting pace. And that's just might be one example. Perhaps it's you have to hit three times cross court before you're allowed to hit a drop shot or redirect down the line, or on the backhand, maybe you have to hit two slices before you're allowed to drive the ball. Whatever it be, just work the point with your variety, your high percentage variety, and the disruptive changes in speeds and spins before you go to the power. After Alcaraz beat Sinner, the entire Alcaraz camp pointed to the head or the cabeza. Positive reinforcement for the way Carlitos played. Other possible reasons he was able to break those habits. Playing in conditions that suit him so well. Conditions that he could draw great memories from at Indian Wells. But those slower, grittier, higher bouncing hard courts that he moves so well on, that he has the power and the weight of shot to hit through with ease. I just think that Indian Wells, when it's all said and done, might be one of his favorite courts on the tour. So far, it's looking like that. Maybe he had felt enough pain from his slump that rock bottom theory set in. Rock bottom theory is the best way for habits to change is through pain. And in tennis terms, it's to take enough losses that make you upset enough that you change something. It's rock bottom theory. For Coco Gauff, it was the first round loss against Kenin at Wimbledon, right? just as an example. And the other thing is just respect for the opponents that he was playing down the stretch here. When you're playing a Jannik Sinner who's won 18 matches in a row, who has beaten you twice in a row, it is pretty easy to subscribe to the idea that you have to do some things that are both different from what you normally do and perhaps a little bit more uncomfortable or more unnatural, I should say, than what you have gotten used to doing. Especially after you lose a set 6-1 in the first, well, now you're even more likely to buy into some changes, to make some adjustments. So let's get into the Sinner match first. And we can start with the first set. That was a 6-1 Sinner win. Alcaraz threw in a loose service game after the rain delay. Four unforced errors. Two backhand misses, a forehand miss, a double fault. It was exactly the kind of game that had been popping up too often in Alcaraz's tennis. It's going to happen once in a while. It's really hard to avoid. But the great players, the truly elite players, especially in big matches, often go entire matches without ever having that four unforced error game where you basically just hand it over on a platter. Alcaraz also just struggling for pace absorption on the forehand. Sinner hitting a lot of big backhands down the line, a lot of big forehands inside in, whenever he would have a chance to inject pace. And Jannik has that top tier pace that was pushing Alcaraz back, that was drawing misses on the forehand side of Alcaraz, and also drawing some short balls, some attackable balls. They were playing lots of very fast rallies, power to power, not a lot of mixing of speeds or heights. Sinner is going to be more consistent in these rallies. He absorbs pace better. He redirects the ball better. His backhand has more margin. He centers the ball on his forehand a little bit more consistently. And it was the same thing. I found myself thinking the same thing, not watching live, so I knew what would ultimately happen. But to me, it looked like the Zverev match at the Australian Open, where I was asking the question to Alcaraz, why are you hitting everything so big when it's clearly counterproductive? Second set starts. There's more serve and volley. He's slicing the backhand more. He's coming in on anything short. He's also sneaking in whenever he feels the ball leave his strings and he reads that the outgoing ball is precise and damaging and that Sinner might float the next ball. And Alcaraz is so athletic in his ability to hit the delayed approach. Maybe he didn't know it was going to be an approach shot, but feeling the ball leave his strings well and then dart in. A lot of drop shots as well. So net rushes, slices, drop shots. Look at the break of serve that was the first real positive twist in the match for Alcaraz at 1-2 in the second set. Look at that game. So Alcaraz wins 4 points. Let's go through all four. There was forehands cross court. He just went cross court with a build, cross court with an approach, put away a forehand volley winner. At 15 all, Alcaraz slices a backhand cross court. Sinner has to go down low to get his backhand, and he misses it. So it's a slice to an error. At 15:30, Alcaraz plays deep in the court. He's hitting slower, higher forehands cross court to Sinner, and Jannik misses a forehand down the line for an unforced error. So, okay, we're adding a little bit of height. We're adding a little bit of spin. And then at 15:40, Sinner hits a backhand trade that kind of lands in the kill zone, too central. Alcaraz hits a forehand inside in approach. It's really big, great approach shot, forehand volley winner. So of those 4 points, how many were Alcaraz running side to side on the baseline, hitting every ball straight and hard? None. Not a single point did Alcaraz not either throw in some variety or finish at net. Later on, Alcaraz needed to save a break point, and it's worth mentioning the backhand down the line. Very special at 30-40. I mentioned that Sinner was looking for his backhand down the line, his forehand inside in, and certainly with Alcaraz in a very stressful position running into his backhand corner, Sinner started to look for the cross court, presumably so he could hit a backhand down the line or a forehand inside in on the next ball. And Alcaraz just caught him by surprise and went big open stance backhand down the line. There was a lot of open court there. So in a way, it was a low percentage attempt in the sense that Alcaraz's weight was in the sense that he was on the run, that the incoming ball was pretty good from Sinner. But there was a decision maker that suggested that the attack was open, which is the opponent's court position. Sinner was not in position to cover the down the line at all there. So if you feel balanced, which Alcaraz clearly did, then I really like the shot. And that was a key moment in the match. Alcaraz holds and wins the second set. In the third set, Sinner got really erratic. But if you look at the balls that were leading to Sinner's missed forehands, a lot of them looked very similar. They were slower. They were higher. Sometimes deliberate from Carlos, throwing in the loopier shots. Sometimes it wasn't deliberate. It was a slight mishit, or it was a stab return, or Alcaraz defending from an emergency position, and therefore putting more height on the ball and taking a lot of pace off the ball. But Sinner was struggling off of the higher, slower stuff with his forehand. What are the challenges that a ball like that presents? It is harder to find the proper height of contact because the ball is not coming in as straight, because it's coming as a loop. You need to find, in order to catch the ball between your hip and your shoulder, which is where you want to catch the ball, you actually have to get your feet in a very precise position in order to accomplish that. So that's an added challenge. It is more difficult to find the right tempo on your forehand. And when I say tempo, I just mean the timing of your take back to the time that you actually accelerate your racket after you drop it below the level of the ball and swing low to high. So it's more difficult to find your tempo, and it's more difficult to create enough pace to hit through a speedy Carlos Alcaraz, who is usually in a better position to defend because he had more time to get himself into that position because the ball was slower. So there are plenty of, look, you don't necessarily want to get into a habit of giving Sinner a lot of time on the ball on his forehand. He can be very deadly when that is the case. But there are also things under certain circumstances, and this is how it played out in the third set, where, yeah, maybe Sinner's forehand will get really erratic when you give him higher and slower stuff. And that's what happened in this third set. Tons of errors from Sinner. Not a good set from Jannik, but by any means. Now, was it because Sinner was hurt? He was stretching out his calf. There was a point where he fell on his left side and kind of looked like he maybe jammed his wrist. Tough to say for sure. What I will say is the movement looked fine, but there's also a mental component that can't completely be thrown aside. Perhaps the discomfort that Sinner was feeling in his calf, or maybe the uncertainty that he was feeling about his wrist, whether it be pain or discomfort or tightness or whatever it was, that's distracting. That can cloud the mind. It can lead to a dip in level, even if there isn't a severe injury. And that is true. What is also true is we need to be careful about attribution error. And the same thing happened with Tommy Paul in the second set against Medvedev in the tiebreak. This was the semifinal where Paul has this little ankle roll. Wasn't a severe ankle roll. Movement was fine. Didn't win another point for the rest of the tiebreak. And now you're left in a position where you're like, well, we saw the ankle roll. We saw what happened after the ankle roll, which was a dip in level, but was it because of the ankle roll? We do need to be careful about assuming that it was, especially when there's no visual evidence that injuries like this are are, you know, affecting movement in a big way or something like that. Just because we know that one of the potential outcomes, ankle roll aside, is that Medvedev's going to take control of the tiebreak in that situation against Tommy Paul. That Tommy might make some errors. And in this case, with Sinner and Alcaraz, it did seem like Carlitos had some momentum before any of this. But, you know, maybe Alcaraz was going to win the third set 6-1, and Sinner's forehand was going to be erratic in the third set. My only point is we'll never know how much those injuries affected what we saw subsequently, but I think we should just have an open mind on both ends of the spectrum, that they had a great effect and that they maybe had not so much of an effect at all. Let's get to the Medvedev match, the final. First three games, Alcaraz made an unbelievable volume of errors. It was a really, really erratic start by Carlitos. But from there, he felt like the better player pretty consistently. And I want to start with the serving. Even though it's not the most sexy thing to talk about, it never is, I do think that it's really important in this matchup. What I've always said is it's an area where Daniil needs to build an advantage. When Medvedev beats Alcaraz, he wins the battle of cheap points, and the serve is a weapon for him. And in this match, not even almost. Big thanks to Tennis Insights, because we have a really, really good graphic and some very good data on what the serving battle looked like in this particular meeting between Medvedev and Alcaraz. We can see that aces were 3-3. Unreturned serves were Alcaraz 16, Medvedev 8. Carlitos hit double the amount of service winners as Medvedev. Had to do with the quality of the serve itself, also probably aided by the fact that Daniil felt he needed to stand closer to defend against the serve and volley, which is something that Alcaraz used to beat him on such a regular basis. Really, every time they've played, Alcaraz's serve and volley has been affected, including the U.S. Open match that Medvedev won. So Alcaraz wins the battle of cheap points in this match, not Medvedev. And that's a problem for Daniil. Now, you can also see in this graphic that Daniil did get a lot of plus one balls to attack, which is a signal of first serve effectiveness. And in the cumulative metric that Tennis Insights has developed here, which is serve effectiveness, plus one balls in attack is part of the number. I will say that's part of what is deemed as an effective first serve. That's good. There's no doubt that it's good that Medvedev got so many plus one balls to attack. In my opinion, not good enough. Knowing what we know about Medvedev's plus one and his transition game, knowing what we know about Alcaraz's defense, his ability to scramble and neutralize, I don't think it's good enough that Medvedev got a lot of plus one balls to attack. He needs to win points with his serve outright in order to have success in this matchup, in my opinion. And if you add up aces and unreturns and attacking plus ones, you still get an advantage for Alcaraz. 66.5% of Alcaraz's serves resulted in one of those three positive outcomes. 63.3% of Medvedev's. So it's small. It's not a huge advantage, but it's a slight advantage for Alcaraz in an area where I think Medvedev needs to have an advantage. So let's go to the rest of the stuff. In the first set, goes to a tiebreak. This is an example of how the serve was taken out of this match. If you look at the first set tiebreak, there were not a lot of short points. There were no aces. I don't believe there was a single service winner. I don't think there were even a lot of quick, like, plus one points. They were getting in a lot of neutral situations. And in those neutral situations, the Alcaraz forehand, it loomed large. It was really, really outstanding. The first 4 points that Alcaraz won in this tiebreak were all with some sort of forehand attack. Either it set up an easy volley or it finished the point on its own. At 5-all, Alcaraz serving misses his first serve, and he hits a second serve 107 miles per hour off the service line right at Medvedev's forehand. You have a lot going there. Oh, and by the way, Daniil was standing in because he's changed his tactic against Alcaraz, and he felt like he needed to try to take time away and rush Alcaraz on the second return. So Medvedev standing in, the serve is 107 miles per hour. It skids off the service line, which Daniil talked about after the match, how he can't understand why they can't make white paint that doesn't make the ball skid. And I agree with Daniil. It's a great point. And then the fourth factor is it went at Medvedev's forehand. You're more likely to get a miss, a return miss, when you serve at Medvedev's forehand compared to his backhand. So Medvedev misses the return. Alcaraz gets the cheap point. And I kind of lied. I said there are no service winners, but I really meant on the first serve, because Alcaraz gets a huge one here at 5-all. And then on the next point at 6-5, he shows off the patience that we're talking about. He hits three forehand trades cross court in a row. I know that might sound like a nothing statement, might sound like it's completely normal, like, congrats, bro. You hit three cross-court forehands in a row, neutral. I'm telling you, I just didn't really see Alcaraz doing much of that at all recently. It's just not how he was playing. He would get by the third ball, maybe even by the second, he would get antsy and he would just do something, whether it be a drop shot or a down the line or an injection of huge pace or an attempt to paint the sideline with a sharp angle. But if you look at the three forehands he hit in a row on this set point, margin, height, medium pace, just normal rally balls. And it's Medvedev who is the first to pull the trigger and try to redirect with his forehand down the line, catches it a little bit late. It goes wide. That's an error. First set tiebreak goes to Alcaraz. And then in the second set, he really pulls away in a big way. There were more Medvedev errors, big second serve returns by Alcaraz off of a lot of slow Daniil second serves, some really important scrambles by Alcaraz on Medvedev service games where it just seemed like Medvedev on his approach shots was never getting easy volleys and was losing points as a result. Alcaraz on his service games was getting a lot of those free points and playing with a really, really good consistency, particularly on the forehand. Alcaraz was very buttoned up in the second set. I feel like in general, in these conditions, Alcaraz is too strong physically from the back of the court for Medvedev. He has the artillery to penetrate with the power, obviously the droppers and the volleys to complement that power. And Medvedev, in order to get the ball through Alcaraz, I feel like he needs to be perfect. The forehand doesn't quite get through. As I said, the approach shots just don't create the high volleys that he's looking for. And I think the weight of shot is a really, really big deal because Medvedev's flat ball, it's slowed down a lot by these courts. And it's tough with Alcaraz moving as well as he was moving. Whereas I have no doubt when Alcaraz loads up for a forehand, even if it's not inside the court, he can have 2 feet behind the baseline, but when he loads up for a forehand from the middle of the court, I have confidence that Alcaraz is going to create serious, serious damage. And then when he steps in for the approach shot, I feel confident that whatever the result, whether he drop shots or he drives and approaches, that Carlitos is going to be able to create that offense with ease. And for Medvedev, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, I don't know. Like, unless he forces an error, I'm not feeling as good about Daniil's chances from those positions. Biggest constant in both matches. I'm moving on now from the Medvedev match. I want to make one more point about both matches. I think one of the best things that Alcaraz has done here was just alter the production of his forehand slightly. And what I was seeing out of his forehand was an ability to spread the court with precision and topspin, like Nadal. Look, Nadal brings really good forehand speed. There's no doubt about it. He generates pace really well. But when he's dictating with his forehand, it's the repeatability of it. And It's how well he opens up the court and, you know, creates angles and makes you move. That's the reason why Nadal is the deadliest player in the history of tennis when he's dictating with his forehand. And instead of Alcaraz just trying to hit the ball Mach 8, I saw a lot more of that repeatable precision dictating with the heavy, high RPM forehands here. On the cross-court trade, heavy, not necessarily fast, heavy. Big kick off the court. That's effective. That's bothersome. Alcaraz can really ramp up the RPMs and can make the ball jump out of his opponent's strike zones. Forehand inside in. Instead of blasting through the baseline with the forehand inside in, create that nice sideline breaking short angle. Make the ball dip hard into the court and break that left sideline on the forehand inside in. I feel like Alcaraz kept doing that against Medvedev in the second set and against Sinner at times, where they were hitting, you know, running forehands from outside the court off of Alcaraz's forehand inside in. We do have some stats. We do have some data, some insights, and this is not Monday Match Analysis exclusive. This was actually in Tennis Majors, a piece by Simon Cambers. Let's see look at the Alcaraz forehand. Let's start with percent of forehands in. For Indian Wells, Alcaraz made 86% of his forehands. In the last year, that number is 83. The tour average is 84%. So we're talking about small margins because that's what it is on the tour. But that means that Alcaraz in the last year has been below tour average in forehand consistency. And for Indian Wells this year, not only did he get to tour average, he leapfrogged the tour average and got 2 percentage points above it to 86%. So consistency goes up. Average speed, tour average at 74 miles per hour. Alcaraz's year-long average is 75 miles per hour. No surprise to see him above the tour average. Indian Wells this year, 77 miles per hour on average. You might be thinking, well, doesn't that go against some of the things you've said? And I would say more setup, bigger finish, and also more time on the ball in general with these slower courts. I think that the speed of the court giving Alcaraz more time to load up his forehand is part of the reason why we see the speeds high. But I don't think that means that Alcaraz wasn't, like, the key is that he's mixing it up. And he was doing that, even though the average was higher. And then average topspin on the forehand. This is where you see him really blow away the tour average. But average RPM for Alcaraz in the last year, 3,154. Indian Wells, 3,418. Over 200 RPMs more on average for Alcaraz at Indian Wells. More spin, more in. And more speed. I don't know if, like, I guess depth and location of the forehand is something that isn't in this data set, but oh well. I just thought Alcaraz's forehand from the very start this week looked a lot more effective than it has been recently in every single way. More varied, more deadly, more consistent, period. Phoenix Challenger. Let's talk about it. First, I'll talk about players who stood out to me. So I'll get into the tennis side of things first, and then I'll talk more about personal experience. All right, so Borges. Borges defends the title. All of his shots are really good. Everything he does with his tennis racket is excellent. I'm talking about his forehand, his backhand, his serve, his volleys. It's all really good. The movement, the athleticism, that's where he's going to lag behind the elite players. He's working on it. Let's see how far he can take it. But that's really what Nuno Borges is all about. But I do want to say that I love his mentality. I love the position that he's in his career. He's one of those guys who didn't expect to have any of this. He had no expectations for himself. He was not that good growing up as a kid. He went to college. When he turned pro, I don't think he expected at any point in time, really, to be a top 50 player. So all of this is gravy. That reduces expectation. It allows him to play with a certain level of freedom. And he was asked after one of these matches about, like, oh, you make this big run at the Australian Open, fourth round at the Australian Open. How does that alter your expectation? And I loved his answer because it was straight facts, as the kids would say. Borges was like, you got to be careful with expectation. Just because I made the fourth round of the Australian Open doesn't mean I'm going to do anything the next week. And sure enough, I mean, he did make his first tour quarterfinal, but he came into Phoenix off back-to-back first round losses. So I think Borges has a really, really good mindset where there's not a lot of, he doesn't put a lot of pressure on himself. He also has a desire to improve. It's a really good combination to have. Berrettini, of course, it was great to see him make a run. It was great to see him back. Selfishly, he provided a great storyline for the event as a whole. He certainly brought the crowds. He brought the social media attention and all of that. And it was great to see him compete again. I'm really happy for him in general as well. His power, it's just different. I watched a lot of tennis last week. I saw a lot of players last week. Nobody brings the muscle on the court that Berrettini brings. And there were a lot of good forehands as well. And Borges is on that list. And a couple of other guys I'm going to talk about are on that list. I mean, Vukic, right? Vukic, he played in the semis. Vukic has a great forehand. But Berrettini, man, there's an extra 10% in the serve. The first serve in the forehand. And the second serve, by the way, which is super underrated and was a big key for him all week. That is just different. I still love him under pressure. I think he's so clear-headed in the big moments. He never holds back. He makes good decisions all the time. He plays his game. I can never see a difference in Berrettini's tactics, whether it's love all or if it's five all in a third set tiebreak. To me, he just plays every point the same. I think it's such a good asset for him. And lo and behold, he wins four tiebreaks in a row here to ultimately make the final. Then he is not quite as clutch in the final as he was in the previous matches. Just got scratchy on the forehand too often this week. That was what did him in. That's why he ended up losing a couple of first sets, having to come from behind. It hurt him in the Borges final. There might have been some footwork stuff at the root of it, just not setting up properly or kind of leaning backwards on some of his plus one forehands, I think, at times. Falling backwards, I should say. The scratchiness on the forehand was the main problem, just that sharpness. But all in all, look, this was impressive. Physically and mentally, to withstand all of the challenges that the rain delays. And if you're not aware, Berrettini had to play two matches on Saturday. So here you are at the end of the week. You haven't played in 6 months, and you have to win two matches in one day. And you win one in a third set tiebreak, the first one, and then you go back out onto court and you win that second match. I mean, come on, how impressive is that for a guy who hasn't played in 6 months? Not to mention his second round match was a 26-hour match, mentally exhausting 26-hour match. And he was able to manage the ebbs and flows of that. His opponent was Arthur Cazot. I'll talk about him next. I did not realize how special of an athlete Cazot is. When I was watching him on TV, Australian Open, all that, it just didn't really hit me through the screen how well he moves like it did here. He is long, lanky, flexible, explosive. I absolutely love his athletic makeup, and I'm excited about him because I saw the serve right away and that it was pretty special how he was able to produce the speed that he does on his serve. I saw that he moves pretty well. I see that he has a lot to his game, even off of the forehand and the backhand. He's volleying. He's hitting drop shots. I didn't realize how well he moved. The concern for Cazot is neither of the ground strokes, forehand, backhand, stand out a ton as being like awesome. But I feel like he can be a Tommy Paul with a better serve. That's my comp for Cazot. I think he can be a Tommy Paul with the better serve. Terrence Ottman, I want to talk about. Lefty Frenchman, hasn't broken into the top 100 yet. If you know him, you may know him from the first round Australian Open match against Medvedev, where he won the first set 7-5. He was kind of right in the match, ended up cramping, retiring. Medvedev says after the match, I was cramping too. As if to say, if Ottman had just held up physically, he may have defeated Daniil Medvedev in the first round. A very real possibility for a Medvedev who would ultimately go on to make the final and be up two sets to love. Ottman's ultra talented. The serve is like a Alexander Dolgopolov, Lloyd Harris, quick fire, slingshot serve, but lefty. Gets a lot of, has a really good slice serve on the ad, and has a great controlling forehand. Heavy RPM forehand. And he moves well. He is also mentally the most volatile player I can ever remember watching. Like, it's actually incredible. I don't say this lightly, but he tanked two sets last week and won both matches. And one of them I witnessed with my own eyes. It was against Svida in the second round. The first round against Sebastian Offner, I didn't see it, but I heard about it. But Ottman goes down a break, gets really upset about nothing in particular. Not the umpire, not a bad call or something his opponent did. Nothing. Just kind of went down a break and went utterly ballistic and then stopped trying. So he's got to work that out. Now, I listened to a good interview with him and Alex Gruskin. He's a very smart guy, a very good guy. And he understands that he's a little bit crazy mentally and gets super angry on the court. And that probably will never change. I think what he needs to change, and it's going to be really interesting to watch him, he needs to make sure that when he gets angry, the effort level is maintained. Otherwise, he's going to lose matches that he otherwise should not. I want to talk about Luka von Asche. He's as advertised. The fitness, the movement, the consistency, just how solid he is. He does really remind me of Diego Schwartzman when it comes to his baseline game. But his first serve, and this is all that I kind of knew already. One thing I think watching live that changed my opinion was his first serve. I think it's a lot better than Fanini, Schwartzman, Baez, probably a little better than Ferrer. He's got a first serve at 5'10" that is decent. And for that reason, I think even more highly of his potential. He's done a lot already in terms of accomplishments for a 19-year-old. Now, do I think the ground stroke speeds are a little low? Do I think he needs to look at maybe like an Alex de Minaur and see that as a model of, okay, I need to kind of do what he's done recently, and there's always going to be a concern if I don't hit a little bigger than I currently do? Yes, I do. But I think, you know, von Asche is like a lock, in my opinion, to be a top 20 player. Basically a lock. Last guy is Zach Svida. I hope he has success at some point. I'm not sure. I'm not positive. But he's a very interesting player to me. He is probably the closest thing to Gilles Simon I have seen since Gilles Simon. Not technique-wise. You know, technically, he doesn't look like Simon. But just in the tranquility in which he plays the game. Doesn't swing the racket very fast. Has no interest in that. Hits the ball pretty softly, but he keeps it deep. He doesn't miss. He moves unbelievably well, and he does not get tired of running from corner to corner to corner to corner. He does not get tired, and he covers a lot of ground. And it feels like he'll never, ever in a million years miss a backhand. So Zach Svida to me was interesting. That's all I got. Obviously, I enjoyed a lot of other, you know, watching a lot of other guys. I formed a lot of other different opinions. But those to me are the headliners. Especially, I wanted to talk about instances in which my opinions were really changed, where there are a lot of guys, I watch them live and it's like, yep, this is exactly what I thought. And, you know, I leave Phoenix with the same opinion of this player as I arrived in Phoenix with. As far as my experience, look, first of all, I've said this before, but I want to double down on it. And I hope anybody who watched feels this way. I mean, great job by the team, the ATP, and the production team, which is done by actually an outside company, just to elevate the product, to make it look as good as possible. I think the shows looked great, and I think it's going to go a long way, regardless of who's announcing, whether it be me or anybody else. And even if there's no announcer, I think the level of production that is being achieved and being invested in by the ATP and all of the people involved, it is a really awesome thing. It was also fantastic to be on site. I have probably in my career, which has been more or less 3 years now as a tennis broadcaster, I probably called in the ballpark of 500 tennis matches. And all 500 of them have been in a studio, off of a monitor. Like, sure, I do the US Open radio thing where I'm live in the arena, but in terms of television play-by-play of tennis, I have always been in a studio. This is the first time that I was in person. Now, the main benefit of being in person and the great joy of being in person, other than some of the things that you might see with your eyes while you're calling the match or feeling the conditions, like which direction the wind is blowing and all of that, are the conversations that you have when you're off the air with players, with coaches. And I did find that one of the most rewarding and illuminating part of the experiences. But it was not without an adjustment phase for me. Because on Monday, I start commentating. I start announcing like I always do. No difference. And sure enough, three players on Monday, and one of them I had heard about, the others I didn't know about until I was told on Tuesday morning. But three players complained that they could hear my commentary and that it was disturbing them in some way, particularly before, you know, when they were getting ready to serve. Obviously, I'm not talking during the point, but I could still understand why, especially depending on what I'm saying, that when everybody is silent and a player is getting ready to serve, that the sound of commentary can be distracting. So that obviously made me feel like, okay, I need to make an adjustment here and I need to change. In hindsight, do I feel like I overcorrected? I do. I felt like Monday's issues led to an overcorrection on my part. I felt a little bit out of sorts. I feel a little bit self-conscious about how it sounded at some times. A little bit golf announcery, a little bit whispery, and maybe it just took the energy out of it. And I don't know, I think maybe some people didn't mind it, but then some people thought, like, this sounds horrible. What's wrong with this guy? So that's the part that I'm a little bit regretful about. But come Saturday, I was like, okay, there has to be a better way. There needs to be a way where I can be able to sound like I am expressive and energetic and I'm moving my voice around in certain ways and I have some force and some presence without disrupting the players. And I think I was finally able to achieve that balance. Saturday, I feel pretty good about the work that I did. Sunday, I feel pretty good about the work that I did, but it did take a little while. So that was my own experience from a commentary standpoint. I am really happy with the championship point, and I'm going to end on this. I avoided disaster on championship point when Nuno Borges won the title. I'm going to play the audio and see if you can figure out why I avoided disaster on this call. Nuno Borges wins the Arizona Tennis Classic for the second consecutive year. Okay, you heard Nuno Borges fall to the court and begin to yell primally and at a decibel level that I did not know capable. And the on-court microphone very much picked it up. Had I started talking right away, it would have been a wall of noise that would have likely been indiscernible. Like, there's no way whatever I was saying was not going to be drowned out. And ultimately, like, it just would not have sounded good if I had immediately started talking. Luckily, I fell back on something that I usually do when I'm calling a match point and just wait for a second for the natural sounds of the player celebrating and the crowd reacting to play out before I begin speaking. And I'm just so glad that I did that on this championship point. It completely saved me. And it made for a call that I could end up being happy about. So there's your inside baseball when it comes to broadcasting. As I move forward and I do a mailbag, you guys want to ask me any questions about my experience at the Phoenix Challenger or any of that, you can go ahead and do that. I hope I can do something similar in the future. Thanks for all of you who watched and reached out. Let me know that you watched. Maybe gave me some feedback. All of that was appreciated. Miami Draw is out already, so I am right back to work after posting this. That'll come out on Tuesday. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.